Well, I wrote the book because I had known Condoleezza Rice kind of from the shadows for several years back in the late 80s when I was a student of Soviet domestic and foreign policy at Stanford University, and she was a professor of the same subject. Ironically, I never had her as a teacher, but I knew of her, of course. A black woman in that subject area is not something you find every day. And then I watched her career, and then, of course, in 2000, she joined the Bush campaign and was his foreign policy guru, and she became even more intriguing and even more enigmatic, actually, in that campaign, and then after 9/11 and the war in Iraq. And then finally in 2004, when the president decided to name her Secretary of State, and at that point she would become the most powerful African American woman in 230 years of American government. And I decided, enough's enough. I need to understand who is Condoleezza Rice, who is this enigmatic public figure. And so I set to find that out.
Why the title Twice as Good?
Twice as Good comes from something that Condoleezza Rice heard growing up, and so did I as an African American, and so did many other African Americans and other minorities, and many women actually heard it growing up. You have to be twice as good, given your status as a minority, a person of color or a female, in order to be considered equal to what other people are. And so Condoleezza Rice heard this growing up, and I think it was a main motivator in everything she's done. I think it all comes back to Birmingham. I think it all comes back to the lessons she learned growing up here in a segregated Alabama as a little black girl. And one of the things she learned was that she had to be twice as good. She had to be far more than better than anyone else in order to be considered good enough. And that's what she was determined to do. And her parents invested her with the determination to be that.
Condoleezza Rice lived in the Titusville community, which is quite literally a few blocks away from where we are right now. And today, as it was when she was here, the area is predominantly black, and income is much lower than more affluent parts of town. What did she leave black Birmingham with that stayed with her? And what do you suppose she left behind here?
Those demographic realities you talk about are exactly right. That neighborhood is predominantly African-American, 95% or more. It also is not as rich as most of the city. The difference in that and it is today as it was then when she was growing up here in the 50s and early 60s. The difference is, however, despite having those same realities and those same demographics back then, it was a place of much greater hope and much greater pride, I would argue, when she was growing up than it is today. And that says it all to me. It says it all, something that we've lost in the African-American community, not just in Birmingham, but throughout, I think, our nation, in the black community. We've lost a certain strength that even during, and the other difference, obviously, is that now black people don't have to live there because there's integration. There was a pride in the middle of that dark time for African-Americans that was so great that Condoleezza Rice was absolutely, I was actually unaware of the darkness. As a little black girl growing up in Birmingham, she didn't know that that they were not as well off as white sections of the city. She didn't know that she was deprived in any way. She didn't know she was oppressed in any way. She was absolutely unaware of that. Her parents and her middle-class community in Titusville convinced her that, number one, you live in an idyllic world, in an idyllic place, and imagine the ability to do that in the heart of segregation. But they did it. And her parents in particular convinced Condoleezza Rice that she could be anything she wanted to be. And so as an 8 or 9 year old girl, she stands in front of the White House when her father had taken her on a trip to Washington, D.C., and she says, "One day I'll be inside this house." Now, that is an incredibly delusional statement for a little black girl from Birmingham to make in that year when she couldn't eat a hamburger downtown because the restaurants were all segregated and the lunch counters did not allow African Americans to eat there. Now, that's extraordinary, but she believed she would one day be in that house, and as it turned out to be the case, one day she was in that house. So I think this kind of pride, this kind of determination was willed to her in that Titusville neighborhood back then growing up. And I think she took that with her, right down to the way she carries herself, her bearing, that utterly erect posture and the head straight forward and the shoulders square, that determination, never giving in, never admitting when one's wrong in a congressional testimony, that kind of thing. All that kind of determination never to show weakness and that determination to always be incredibly proper and incredibly erect. I think these are things that the black middle class invested her with as a little girl growing up here in Birmingham. These were defenses against segregation, the humiliation of Jim Crow. That's what these things were. Now, she took all those with her. I think, unfortunately, what she's left behind here, I think, you know, lots of the old-timers in Titusville, and I talked to a lot of folks during the 2 years of research for the book, are still around, and they still have a certain pride, obviously. But Titusville itself is a much more depressing place today than it was then, even though in many ways we as a people, African-Americans, are better off today. And African-Americans in Birmingham in middle class ways are better off today. But you don't feel it. You feel... You feel there's a certain lack of hope. You feel in Titusville and in Birmingham. You know, the young men you see down in the street corners downtown. Those, you know, all those department stores that Martin Luther King marched to have integrated that now today are empty hulks of buildings downtown. You know, there's something that was lost with integration, I think. And Condi Rice and I talk about that in some of our interviews for the book.
She finally did make it to that house, as you mentioned. Do you think there's anything that happened there during her years in Washington that may have changed her mind about anything?
Well, you know, a lot happened. It was, as she put it to me, you know, when she was telling me how she didn't plan to be Secretary of State in the second Bush administration. That first administration, that first term, as she told me, was the worst terrorist attack in our nation's history. 9/11, of course. It was also, we had launched two major wars, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. As she told the president that she was tired, and she thought maybe he needed a new team. She told everyone close to her, her parents, she told her stepmother, she told her friends and family, that she was ready to come home. She was ready to come back to California, and that she did not want to be Secretary of State. But the president asked her to do it, and so she decided to stay. And the reason she decided to stay was because she felt that the reason we invaded Iraq was because she felt we needed to change the Middle East. After 9/11, she felt we could no longer allow kind of repressive regimes to hold sway there and lead to frustration, and especially amongst young Muslim Arab men. And that frustration would lead to, and in some cases it did lead to in 9/11, did lead to terrorism. And so she felt we had to change the Middle East for that reason. And that was something she didn't go into this White House believing. She went into this White House as someone who's more of a realist, someone who believed that American foreign policy should be about interest, and that's what governed the world, was power and the interest of different countries, what countries wanted to achieve and who had the power to achieve it. But after 9/11, she decided that we needed to transform the world. She became more of an idealist, more of in the mold of George W. Bush, whereas when she got to this White House, she was more in line with the thinking of George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush. And so that changed.
You write in your book that the members of Rice's family that she's closest to, her mother's side, and the people with which she surrounds herself personally are basically liberal Democrats. Where did she get her more conservative values from, and how have they lasted for so long?
Well, you know, it was one of the more interesting parts of the book. I mean, because there were lots of surprises in 2 years of researching this book. You know, from the personal side of Rice, that she likes bad boys, men who are bold and bodacious, not the sweet, kind, open the door kind of guy.
These are the guys that she dated.
Absolutely.
In college.
That's who she's attracted to. Yeah. She's only been engaged once, and it was to a former, at that point, he was a current NFL Denver Bronco. And mm-hmm. her two boyfriends at Notre Dame when she was getting her master's degree were Fighting Irish players, you know, football players. So she's a great football fan and a great fan of football players, which I didn't know. And I go into the book about how the connection between wanting bold men led her to some. In some ways, to George W. Bush. Her values are not nearly as conservative as we think. And because Condoleezza Rice, and again, the big part of this book was getting behind this public mask that she has, which also, I think, goes back to Birmingham and Titusville. Mm-hmm. It was a real Southern Black value that you do not share your inner self with the world. There's a public mask that's always one way, and you do what's appropriate, and what's appropriate emotions at any time, that's what you show. Then there's a private self. And those two have no need to be connected. That mm-hmm. was a Southern Black value. And it was, again, one of the survival skills in segregation. If you were to show your real feelings in the middle of Jim Crow, that could get you killed. So you showed this implacable, immovable, strong, invulnerable mask to the public. That's what you did. And Condoleezza Rice still does that. Part of that mask includes this illusion, I think, that she's more conservative than she is. As you said, you know, her best friends and all her family are Democrats, and most of them are liberal Democrats. Condoleezza Rice, you know, is herself a pro-choice Republican. She is in favor of gay rights. She opposes a constitutional ban against same-sex marriage, which this president has stood up for all these things. But we don't know those things about Condoleezza Rice because she doesn't share those things very often in public because that's not a part of the mask. Her mask, her goal right now, her discipline right now is to serve this president, to ensure his legacy. That's why she stayed for the second term, was to save what looked like, you know, a very tough row to hoe in Iraq. And so she wanted to be there to help him build a new Middle East, and she felt he needed her to do that. And that's why she stayed, to salvage George W. Bush's legacy and to help build a new Middle East. That's always very conscious. She's always very conscious to duty and discipline. These are Rice family values that, again, go back to Birmingham. The Reverend John Rice, her father, was just like that and running his Westminster Presbyterian Church in Titusville and 6th Avenue South. And those values are still her values. And so she doesn't show the kind of libertarian side of her that's much more socially liberal than the president she serves, because that's not what she's here for. That's not her goal now.
I want you to read a passage from your book. This is from page 234 from the chapter titled Schooled. And it's in reference to a post 9/11 60 Minutes interview with Ed Bradley, and whether she, like the former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark, would apologize for not seeing the threat or for not doing anything about the threat, whatever your point of view. This paragraph is about Rice's steely resolve. Read a bit of that.
Beyond political considerations, it was also true that apology was not in Rice's personal lexicon. Like George Bush, she met criticism with strength, not contrition. Humility does not come easily to the Rices, said Condi's cousin, Connie Rice, and it was anathema to Condoleezza. She's not that flexible, said Clara Rice. That's her stepmother. She strives for perfection, and admitting a mistake is like a sign of weakness.
A few times in your book, you call her unflappable or always on message. She's always on. Where do you suppose she gets that from?
You know, I think it goes back to Birmingham. I think it goes back to that sense in the black middle class that your goal is not to tell the public how you feel about something. That's a kind of immature, self-indulgent way of being. This kind of confessionary America we live in now, where it's all about reality TV and Oprah, the Oprah age, where we are about sharing our inner selves. That was not the values of the Southern African American community.
But is it unflappable? Isn't that sort of, you're not being chided? Or while being chided, you're not succumbing to your emotions to lash out or to, you know, you do mention in your book that she is always on key. She's always on message. She doesn't deviate from that at all. That comes from the civil rights movement?
You know, I think not from the civil rights movement, but from surviving Jim Crow, I think that's where it comes from. As you said, that whole, you know, not reacting emotionally to anything, that again, that was a survival
sort of stoicism.
That was a survival technique, I think. Because you can imagine if one reacted emotionally to the situation they were living in Titusville and throughout the city and throughout
the South. In 50s and 60s Birmingham, yeah.
Exactly. If one reacted emotionally, one could get killed for reacting emotionally to something that was a humiliating situation, and one encountered oftentimes, not when one was in Titusville itself, when one stayed in one's black community, but when one went outside of it and encountered people of other races. That's where you risk being humiliated. But inside your own community, it was this wonderful cocoon in many ways. That's the way people described it to me. But it was when they encountered white Alabama, white Birminghamians outside of the Titusville neighborhood, that if you reacted as you felt emotionally, genuinely, you could get in real trouble. The second thing, I think, is a survival technique and even a method of finding accomplishment, which is you don't let outside obstacles deter you in any way. You know what your goal is, and this, I think, was something that led the Rice and the Rays, her mom's side of the family, to succeed even before there was a movement, even before there was a king here in Birmingham, which is, regardless of the outside obstacles, you know what you want to do. In their case, back then, it was to get an education. It was to have some power, to carve out what power one could, in the midst of Jim Crow, and what education one could and what affluence one could. And they did that. They did it pretty successfully on both sides of her family. And they did it going back to slavery when they actually would learn to read even when it was prohibited. And there were slave owners as well as slaves on both sides of the family. But I think those values also instilled in Rice this determination that it doesn't matter what the questions are from the questioner, whether the questioner is Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, making the very human, demand, will you apologize to the families of 9/11 victims like Richard Clark did, like the former White House counterterrorism expert just did, in his testimony to the 9/11 Commission when you testify? And Rice keeps coming back saying, you know, she doesn't answer the question. She ignores his question. And again, any of us would feel compelled.
I don't think that's any different. It's not much different than from other politicians in Washington either.
I think that's true. But I think most human beings would feel compelled to answer it. And you're right. I mean, many politicians wouldn't. But Rice, even amongst politicians, she sticks to this kind of this amazing absolutist value of not giving an inch, never saying to Bradley once, that's not my role. Instead, she just keeps saying, no one can deny Ed. She keeps taking this emotional distance from it.
Right.
No one can deny the trauma and the pain of 9/11. You know, that's what she keeps saying. And she sounds like a robot in the end.
She wields a lot of power in the Bush administration and has as NSA chief, as Secretary of State now, and has had a fight on her hands as it pertains to members of the Axis of Evil, namely North Korea and Iran. And she was much more hard-line with the third member of that trio, Iraq, with tough talk in the run-up to the war there. But she seems to be more conciliatory, or anyway, more diplomatic as it pertains to those other cases, Iran and North Korea. Who did she have to fight in the administration for that viewpoint to succeed?
A lot of people. The people she had to fight in the beginning, included the vice president and included the secretary of defense, who formed their own kind of axis of power inside this administration through the first and the first half of the second term. One of the interesting things about Rice I discovered, because the conventional wisdom on Condoleezza Rice is that she was weak, and at the beginning of the George W. Bush presidency, when she came in, she was actually rolled over by Rumsfeld in particular, but by also the titans, by Powell and Rumsfeld and Cheney and these great men of great experience in government who had clashed with each other, and Rice couldn't control them as national security advisor. And that was one of her jobs, to coordinate government management of foreign policy and national security. What I discovered was that wasn't the case. What I discovered was she actually it wasn't a question of her being weak. It was a question of her doing things like she had had, as things had been done in the first George H.W. Bush presidency. In that White House, when Rice was a younger person working for Brent Scowcroft, who was then National Security Advisor, the departments actually did the work. They were operational, state and defense. They carried out foreign policy. All the NSC did was advise. All the National Security Council did, and the National Security Advisor who led it, was to advise. That's what Scowcroft did. That's what Rice did as a Scowcroft deputy for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And that's what she planned to do as George W. Bush's National Security Advisor. What she didn't realize, however, was that this was a very different Bush presidency. This presidency was not disciplined. George H.W. Bush's presidency was not only disciplined, but the president had great foreign policy experience. This president had no foreign policy experience. Condoleezza Rice, actually, in 2000, had invested George W. Bush with his foreign policy credibility. He has very little traveled as Texas governor. Rice failed to realize these distinctions. But it wasn't a question of weakness. It was a question of being slow to respond to the reality of the administration. And by the time she did respond, she actually, and this surprised me because I wasn't aware of this, she actually ended up outfoxing and outmaneuvering Donald Rumsfeld. And by 2004, when Bush is up for reelection, already Rice is bringing back to the National Security Council operational details of American foreign policy, taking it away from State Department and from Colin Powell's folks, but also taking it away from Donald Rumsfeld, supposedly the all-powerful, all-Machiavellian, Svengali of this administration. So it's really extraordinary to see this attention to power and to how Condoleezza Rice is constantly accruing it, even as she is fighting other people in this administration, chiefly Donald Rumsfeld. And by 2007 now, we see a policy on Iraq, We see a policy on Iran, wanting to talk to Iran, wanting to talk to Syria. We have see a policy on North Korea where we have a nuclear deal that the neocons and the far right was opposed to, has been opposed to for the last 7 years of this administration. The Condoleezza Rice rammed through the White House over the objections of the vice president. So her power has never been greater. Is that power enough to change our so far disastrous road in Iraq? I don't know, but it's fascinating to see, and I go to it into in the book about how she accomplishes it. It's fascinating to see this accrual of power, this ability to defeat anyone eventually. That's what we see in her 7 years in this administration.
There are more than a few people who believe that Dr. Rice has a future in politics, that her stint in the White House won't end in January 2009. How does she play that, do you suppose?
Well, you know, it's interesting because she's a real Presbyterian, you know, daughter of a Presbyterian minister. And one of the Presbyterian tenets is predestination. Condoleezza Rice, another surprise that I discovered, has never made another long-term goal in her life since she was 17 years old. At 17, she discovered she wasn't good enough to be a concert pianist, and that's the one goal she had worked for from the age of 3 to 17 with a discipline that none of us could imagine for a little child, but it was kind of scary to people in Titusville. They still talk about it today about how it seemed a bit unnatural how disciplined she was, in fact. But when that goal evaporated when she was 17, because she decided she wasn't good enough to be a concert pianist, Rice never made another long-term goal. And so all these things she's accomplished, these historical accomplishments, from provost of Stanford University at just 38, the first non-white male, first person under 60 to ever have that job, to national security advisor, to secretary of state, she never actually wanted to be any of these things. She never said, one day I want to be that. It didn't happen. Since she was 17, her modus operandi has been to work really hard at the job at hand, and to let God take care of what comes next. Again, this predestination idea. So when I asked her, what are you going to do after this White House? She said, I haven't thought about it. And I really believe that's true. I think if you have Barack Obama and or Hillary Clinton on the Democratic ticket, and conceivably you could have both of them on the Democratic ticket for 08, I think whoever the Republican nominee is, and whatever the situation in Iraq, I think you may, I think you will see that person make a call to Condoleezza Rice about joining the bottom of his ticket.
Marcus Mabry, author of Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.